Welcome to the Compliance Perspectives Podcast. I'm Adam Turtletaub from the Society of Corporate Compliance and Ethics and Healthcare Compliance Association. Joining us today from New York is Alexander Stein, PhD. Alex is the founder and managing partner at Dolus Advisors and a principal at the Boswell Group. Alex, thanks for taking the time to talk to us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Adam. Thank you so much for inviting me.
So I think it would be good if you could tell us about your professional background and trajectory and basically briefly explain how your perspective approach to enterprise, you know, ethics and compliance issues differs from many others because of that.
So my PhD is in psychoanalysis, and I began my career as a clinician in private practice treating patients broke out of the confines of the consulting room. I used to talk about it as going from practicing psychoanalysis to deploying psychoanalysis in the business world. However, the core understanding and set of expertise that come with my training and clinical experience are very much present in the work that I do. And what that means is that I bring a very deep focus on the underpinnings of behavior and decision making. And I advise senior executives and boards on psychologically complex areas of leadership, culture, and ethics, bring to bear a way of understanding the deeper human element in individuals and in group dynamics that can give rise to the problems in ethics that we see so often today.
Yeah, and that's really what intrigued me, is because I think the biggest question in compliance is often, what were they thinking? You know, why did they think the rules didn't apply to them? Why did they think it was okay to do X, Y, or Z? So as someone with a background like yours, let me just ask you, what were they thinking?
Right. So, you know, the first question about that is to ask, why do you assume that they were thinking or that they were thinking about what they were doing? You know, so many people just operate in a kind of reflex mode. And many of the things that we encounter in organizations, but both, you know, legitimate, potentially useful executive decision making, as well as various forms of wrongdoing, are not as deeply considered as we might like to suppose that they are. You know, one approach is to begin to think about, you know, what else is at play within an individual or within a group of individuals in an organization where they should be thinking, where they should be more cognizant and self-aware of what they're doing and what the implications are of their decisions, and why aren't they? You know, one approach to that whole array is to bear in mind that wrongdoing, you know, ethics transgressions and compliance violations can be triggered by one person who wasn't thinking, or who wasn't paying attention, or who was, you know, in some negligent, but also those who are, you know, willfully malicious in some way. But as a general proposition, the idea of the lone wolf or the rogue operator is really more mythology than anything else. And it's pretty hard for one person to wreak a lot of havoc in an organization without help, even though it's not intentional help. And so, you know, the idea of focusing on one person's thinking is to miss the forest for the trees in the ways in which these things play out in requiring many people to have not been thinking in concert together.
You know, and this to me, as you're saying this, leads me to think about the question of culture. You know, we talk a lot about culture and how it can make for better behavior and obviously form a control for someone who might be tempted to go astray, whether for nefarious reasons or just from lack of thinking. What aspects of culture are most effective for controlling behavior?
Well, I know you're just using a term of art when you talk about controlling behavior, but as a term, it already arouses some concern for me. Behavior is enormously hard to control, and by and large, if you try to control behavior, you're probably going to get outcomes that were not what you expected. People's impulses to behave in various ways can be legislated, and you can try to regulate them as best you can, but you really can't control them, per se. You know, a better project is to develop an organizational culture that looks to redirect and to provide alternative solutions for people who are caught in the pincers of some impulse so that they have another direction to go besides wrongdoing. Looking to, put up walls or fences or to erect literally controls against rarely work out as well in action as they appear to in blueprint.
Well, interesting and troubling. Are there any other areas that you found organizations put too much faith in?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the things that comes to mind in thinking about this is Mike Tyson's famous comment that everybody has a plan until they get punched in the mouth, right? So organizations must organize themselves in particular ways. And, you know, you have to believe that what you have thoughtfully constructed, hopefully thoughtfully constructed, is workable. However, you know, faith itself is really a form of magical thinking. So, you know, I wouldn't necessarily recommend any faith-based approaches to managing matters that really need to be more methodically addressed. But, you know, there are a number of things that I see over and over again in organizations. One which really probably stands at the center of everything is the tendency to oversimplify complexity. Organizations, as a general proposition, tend to think reductionistically, and then they rationalize that as an efficiency. But there are a lot of costs that come along with oversimplifying things that are unavoidably complicated. And then one of the other things that comes around a lot that has an unintended consequence is a tendency to avoid deeply understanding and therefore misdiagnosing the root causes of things. So, you know, in compliance and ethics particularly, but not exclusively, you can look at it as the formation of a crisis. And every crisis has a life cycle. There's before, during, and after. And every leader needs to be able to effectively manage a crisis when it arises. But then typically there's a big sigh of relief and, you know, everyone says, well, that's done, let's move on, which is an error because the only way to truly mitigate against recurrence of a particular crisis is to understand how and why it happens. And it's a form of preventative medicine rather than serial triage. So, you know, I consider it very important when I'm brought in to any organizational situation to determine where they think they are with regard to, you know, what's talked about as the maturity of their process, but really it's where are they in that life cycle and where do they think they are and how can various adjustments be made that help to really mitigate some of the unforeseen problems. There are so many blind spots that leaders have, which is not a consequence of any kind of deficiency in their skills. It's just a natural occurrence. And, you know, I take it as one of the implicit mandates of my brief of work whether it's in the contract or not, is to help shine a light on those blind spots with regard to how and why people misbehave when you don't expect them to, where you think that they shouldn't, and what else can be done to the control systems or to the policies and procedures that might prevent that from happening.
Yeah, and preventing in the first place is far better. By the way, I want to go back and just clarify one thing. When you said a faith-based approach, you were speaking about faith in employees, not a religious faith-based approach, correct?
Correct. Although, you know, the overlap of words there is almost unavoidable. I wasn't referring specifically to anything religious, but the idea of putting faith in something requires, you know, really a leap of something that isn't necessarily bound to a scientific understanding. It isn't replicatable. It isn't, you know, methodological. And so, you know, people come into an organization and they make all kinds of decisions, but it isn't necessarily grounded in behavioral science or social science or psychological science that would enable them to more fully understand and grapple with the complexities and all of the different variables that occur in groups of people.
Right. Yeah, and that we've seen over time how infinite those can be. Now, you talked a lot about inoculating organizations, you know, preventative approach. Now, one of the best defenses is to keep ethically compromised people from getting in the front door in the first place. How do we make values-based thinking a part of the interview process? It seems that too often people are willing to look at skills to the detriment of a candidate's values when hiring. How do we help businesses change that thinking?
Yeah, so I certainly agree with you that the idea of values-based approaches are very important, and they deserve to be foregrounded. However, in itself, this form of gatekeeping doesn't necessarily prevent so-called ethically compromised people from coming in the first place. It's so important to bear in mind that every person is capable of all kinds of behavior, right? There is, in fact, almost no such thing as bad people and good people. There are people who are, you know, profoundly damaged and have all kinds of, you know, overwhelming psychopathologies that would cause them to behave asocially or amorally, and you know, there are horrible people among us. But as a general way of thinking about the human psyche, we are all capable of thinking about doing those things. And in many respects, some of the differences between, you know, us and them is that some people do it and some people don't. Right. So trying to weed out people who seem incapable of misbehaving, or who by and large seem to have a good track record for being, you know, of good character and have integrity, is a good thing, but it could be a little bit of a false confidence.
Interesting.
So everyone is fallible. There are no inoculations against being, you know, furious or cruel or self-serving, and people respond to the powerful dynamics of being in a particular environment in different ways, and lots of things will trigger all kinds of primal responses in people that couldn't have been anticipated. And particularly, I'll just add to this, when it comes to, you know, ethics and integrity, that most people who are highly functional in society and in their professions have learned ways of managing and masking many things about themselves in very, very effective ways that enable them to assimilate.
Well, very good caution. Unfortunately, we're out of time. This has been a fascinating conversation. I want to thank you for sharing these insights with us, and I want to thank all of you for taking the time to listen. I'm Adam Turteltaub from SCCE and HCCA saying, I hope we are able to expand your compliance perspective.